second of the three talks on the foundations of scientific socialism. The one tomorrow is going to be led by Dan Styron. It's going to take up the question of the methodology of Mesherzick and Stalinist revisionism. The one today by Bob Langston of the Militant Staff is on the dialectics of revolution. I'm sure all of you are familiar with Bob's writings on the Middle East question in the Militant.
Am I supposed to make this announcement? It says important announcement, since you didn't. All right. Beginning tomorrow, Wednesday, there will be a daily conference bulletin with announcements of meetings, events, etc. Comrades wishing to place notices in the bulletin must bring them to the conference office, second floor lounge, Hosford House, South Hall, no later than 7:30 p.m. Okay. In this talk, I want to try to give a hint, nothing more, of what dialectic is about. George Novak, in his book on the logic of Marxism, does more, and if you have not yet read it, I hope you will. I hope that what I say here will contribute something to your study of that book, and I hope it may help make the masterworks of dialectical materialist investigation a little more accessible to you. I will try to give my hint by concentrating almost altogether on the opposite of dialectical method, on formal metaphysical thinking. This has a certain practical value, I think, because in large part, the application of dialectical method consists in simply avoiding the formalist metaphysical distortions of consciousness imposed on us by intellectual tradition and the existing social order. Even within these limits, however, the presentation has, from a dialectical materialist point of view, at least one major deficiency. The description and analysis of formal metaphysical method includes very little explanation of it in terms of the social economic base out of which it arises. Perhaps we can discuss this question a little bit after the talk. One thing I have tried to do, however, in view of what Dick said what I was going to talk about, is to maintain throughout an emphasis on the relation between dialectic and the making and understanding of revolution. Now, the change in meaning of certain words over a long period of time can be instructive, and this is especially true of the terms revolution and dialectic. And they're cognates in other language. Revolutionem, in ancient and medieval Latin, for example, primarily connoted almost the exact opposite of drastic change, of a violent interruption in continuity. The term meant primarily circular motion, endless repetition of the same, a meaning preserved in the modern English in the cognate revolve, and in such phrases as revolutions per minute. The apparent motion of the heavenly bodies around the sun, around the earth, was the very model. When I first wrote it, I didn't put the apparent in, and then I thought people would accuse me of being obscurantist, so I put the apparent in. And the apparent motion of the heavenly bodies around the earth was the very model of revolutionem. And well into the 18th century, this seems to have been the predominant meaning of the term in English. The first literary occurrence of it in the sense of a political upheaval appears to have been in 1600. The word dialectic, too, has almost reversed its meaning since antiquity. For Plato, dialegomai meant, as its etymology suggests, a talking through, a discussion in which opinions were counterposed and mutually criticized until the eternal, self-sufficient, self-identical form or idea, the true being of the thing under discussion, became evident to the discussion partners, a truth which was all the time present in their souls and preserved in language, but which had been obscured by the shifting, deceptive veil of sense experience and human passion and action. For the modern dialectician, however, it is precisely the essence of things that, although structured and lawful, is temporal, self-contradictory, and deeply entwined with every other thing, while it is the rigid forms or ideas in our souls, generated by historical social processes, and shaping sense experience and determining language accordingly, that obscure the truth of things. Plato, for example, wrote two, or possibly three, dialogues, dialectical investigations, of the state. Though they are quite different from one another in form and conclusion, in each one Plato seeks to define the form or ideal of the state, of which every empirical state, every state we meet someplace in time and space, is a partially real, partially unreal image or reflection, and through which every empirical state can be judged. And this essence or inner reality of the state is, for Plato, justice, which in turn is defined in a way that strikingly resembles the division of labor and the class structure of classical Greek society. Marx, the modern dialectician, began the independent development of dialectical materialism with a criticism of just the aspect of Hegel's thought where, as we shall see, he most blatantly betrays the dialectic and most remarkably resembles Plato, his theory of the state. Through this criticism, Marx was able to establish that the state in its essence is no eternal idea which empirical states more or less closely approximate, but nothing more or less than the historical sequence of empirical states comprehended as the necessary institutionalized violence required to maintain the cohesiveness of specific, antagonistic, class-divided societies. To treat the essence of the state, Marx showed, as any kind of eternal entity really involves selecting some feature of the existing society, idealizing it, and treating it as something inherent in an equally eternal, purportedly, human nature. Theoretically, such a procedure closes off the possibility of understanding the origin and the development of the feature that has been so selected, Plato's justice, which in reality is the social relations of classical Greek slave-based commercial military society, or Hegel's objective reason, which, as we shall see, in reality is the laws governing a commodity-producing society. And practically, such a procedure renders revolutionary action logically impossible, for in the feature that has been selected and idealized, there is an absolute limit which human beings cannot overstep. We may take this as a distinguishing characteristic of formal or metaphysical thinking. To construct an unchanging, non-temporal, self-enclosed entity and to take this entity as the ultimately fully real, while regarding the changing, the temporal, the historical, the related, as less than real, and as deriving such reality as it possesses from the eternal entity behind it. Historically, the development of such a method was, of course, an immense achievement. It necessarily went hand in hand with the power to classify phenomena into practically relevant categories and with the elaboration of the very notion of lawfulness, of persistent patterns in the behavior of things. It received its greatest and clearest formulation in the formal logic and metaphysics of Aristotle, who, at the same time, devoted much effort to trying to reintegrate change and motion into his thought after they had been driven out of it by his fundamental metaphysical commitment. There is, therefore, much great and subtle dialectical argument in Aristotle, but it was not reflected and taken up in his formal logic. And this logic, despite all the refinement it has undergone since, persists today as modern formal logic. In his metaphysics, or as he calls it, first philosophy, Aristotle set out to investigate being as being, to discover the attributes that anything must possess in order to be at all, regardless of what it is. And the first category, underlying all the rest that he discovered, is essence or substance. Now this essence is the principle of organization, conceived as an entity present in each individual that makes it what it is. I, for example, am a human being because this essence, humanity, organizes the matter of which I am composed in a specifically human way. It really isn't funny. I guess I'm making a comic. But I think if it is comic, then most of the logic that we use every day is in reality just as comic. That's what I'm going to show. The essence is thus the soul of the thing, its life, and it is at the same time the species which makes it possible to classify things. Now each essence is absolutely distinct from every other one, and each is eternal and unchanging, though present in a multitude of individuals. Now Aristotle's formal logic is of a piece with his metaphysics of essence. There can, for Aristotle, be a formal logic, a description of the laws of correct thinking and correct discourse, which is independent of the particular content known or talked about, just because every particular content is, in its innermost reality, an unchanging, eternal, self-enclosed essence. For example, the validity of the famous syllogism, all men are mortal, Aristotle is a man, therefore Aristotle is mortal, depends for Aristotle on the presence of eternal humanness in Socrates and on mortality as an unvarying aspect of this humanness. And these metaphysical conceptions of eternality, unchangingness, and self-sufficiency of essence are crystallized in the three formal logical laws of identity, non-contradiction, and the excluded middle, excluded third. The law of identity asserts that everything is identical to itself. For every A, A is A. I am I, this table is this table, the state is the state, capitalism is capitalism, socialism is socialism. The law of non-contradiction states that everything is not other than it is. For all A, A is not non-A. I am not you, this table is not that chair, the state is not society, capitalism is not socialism. The law of the excluded third asserts that every property partitions into two mutually exclusive classes, all things into a class of those things possessing the property and the class of those things not possessing it. For all A and B, A is either B or not B. I am either human or not human. Every object in this room is either a table or a non-table. A society is either capitalist or non-capitalist. These laws are for us self-evident, though the conscious formulation and application of them was an immense achievement in the history of humanity. At the same time, a moment's reflection puts every one of them just as self-evidently into question. Of course I am myself. And of course I was myself yesterday. Yet my today self is not altogether the same as my yesterday self. I have had certain experiences in the meantime. I have at least grown older, if not wiser. Certainly, this table is this table and not that chair. Yet not long ago, both this table and that chair may have been, I was going to say an uncut tree, a mass of some kind of plastic bubbling in DuPont's kettles. And both may have come out of the same kettle. Certainly a horse is a horse, but at what point did a horse become a horse and stop being an eohippus? Of course, a society must be either capitalist or non-capitalist, but since there is today no socialist society, from this it follows with absolute rigor that there can be no socialist society. Of course, every working class must be either revolutionary or non-revolutionary. But from this it follows with rigor that since the U.S. working class is not revolutionary, it cannot be revolutionary. Clearly, our laws of formal logic were much too sweepingly formulated, and certain restrictions or qualifications must be imposed if they are to be valid. As we shall see, these qualifications are very strict, so strict that the only kind of world in which these laws would apply with absolute rigor would be one much like the ideal sphere of essence Aristotle describes. In a certain sense, dialectical logic is simply the logic or structure of thinking and discourse that emerges when these restrictions are eliminated. The first restriction is that we ignore time, history, change. The I that is I, or the table that is table, is not the I of yesterday, or the table as it was during the long route from the tree in the forest to the finished table in this room. There's some wood on that one. Of course, merely from the fact that there has never been a socialist society, it does not follow that there cannot be one. A new possibility has entered the world with the development of capitalism and the Russian Revolution, so that non-capitalist can no longer be identical with pre-capitalist. Moreover, as the concrete analysis of the development of capitalism shows, which is what Das Kapital performed, this new possibility is not just any undefined non-capitalism that is not pre-capitalism. It is rather a specific, determined possibility, socialism. It is the determinate negation of capitalism. This is what dialectical logic refers to in the phrase, the negation of the negation. The negation, revolution, of non-A, capitalism relative to pre-capitalist social formations is not a mere does not necessarily lead to the re-establishment of A pre-capitalist formations, but to the qualitatively new. At the same time, this new, the result of revolution, is not a mere indefinite, unpredictable state of affairs without connection to the existing state of affairs, capitalism, it is itself the determinate negation, socialism, of the existing state of affairs, capitalism. And it is determinate just because it is the self-negation of, the negation arising from within the existing state of affairs itself, the developing capitalist crisis, and the consciousness and power of the proletariat and its allies. The second qualification on the applicability of formal logic is in a way a special case of the first. It involves the relation of the knower or speaker, the logician, to the thing he knows or talks about. It is that the knower must be totally passive with respect to the thing. The knower must not change or affect it in any way. Whatever I say about this table, I must be able to know without scratching it, cutting it, burning it, banging it, dismembering it, or doing anything else whatever to it. Whatever I know about American society, I must be able to learn without acting on it, without participating in anything resembling an effective social struggle, without being involved in or altering it in any way. For the moment the knower is active towards the thing becomes involved in change, in becoming, in time. And the first condition, the abstraction from time that we just talked about, is violated. Or, to put it another way, the laws of formal logic would apply with complete rigor only to things that could be known through pure contemplation. Their validity would imply a total divorce of theory from practice. Against this, of course, stands the dialectical insistence on the unity of theory and practice. I, we, whoever this I is, cannot know except through the constant testing of knowledge in transforming the thing known in practice. The third qualification is, in a certain sense, a generalization of the first, the necessity to abstract from time, history, becoming. It is that we ignore all relations of the thing to other things. Spatially, for example, this table is to my left, but to your right. Left and right contradict each other, however, so I must exclude that table's spatial relations from the consideration of it. Or else, I must assert an absolute point of reference, myself, for example, and thereby say that table is truly to the left. It only appears to you to be to the right. All relations involving time, like causality, for example, are of course excluded by the first qualification, the abstraction from time. But even apparently purely logical relations must be denied, and the terms of the relation separated absolutely from each other. Appearance, for example, is one category, reality is another, and never must they be permitted to contaminate each other. Quantity is one thing, quality something wholly other. To be a completely rigorous formal logician, in fact, I would even have to ignore the relation of the thing to its own defining characteristics, to its own species and genus. I would have to find some way to know this table and to communicate my knowledge without saying or thinking, this is a table. For table certainly involves much that is different from and more than this table. It involves all the tables in the world and all those that aren't. So, when I say, this is a table, I am in fact asserting A is non-A. Strict application of the rules of formal logic would require the limitation of discourse to such an endless tautology as a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. And in fact, it would even preclude such tautology, for by the mere form of the statement, a rose is a rose, a distinction between the rose and itself is asserted. A is non-A. The formal law of non-contradiction contradicts its own form. As Hegel somewhere remarks, strictly to apply it, we would be reduced to the endless invocation of the Hindu Om. Now, over against this denial or ignoring of relation, dialectical logic affirms the unity or interpenetration of opposites, the involvement of each thing in other things, and the truly relative character of the logical categories. Appearance and reality are not separable. Each is only relative to the other, and they are constantly transformed into one another. Quantity and quality are not indifferent to each other. Quantitative changes accumulate, and new quality suddenly emerges. Now, a theory or method shaped by the intellectual attitude that finds its most coherent and systematic expression in formal logic, and I might say in Aristotelian metaphysics, will have certain attributes, all closely associated with the denial of becoming or change. It will tend to isolate different categories or elements from each other and to treat their interconnections as secondary, derivative, or as mere appearance. Or else it will tend to deny the reality of difference, treating it as mere appearance, while locating reality or essence exclusively in some abstract universal, some whole. It will tend to treat change likewise as mere appearance and interpret a new state of things either as a return to some previous state or as the emergence in appearance of some eternally existing reality lying behind the appearance, or in its most radical form, it will tend to treat change as an absolute catastrophe, as the eruption from nowhere of a state that has nothing whatever to do with what has gone before, something which, from the standpoint of the now existing, is nothing at all. It will tend thus to treat some existing forms or structures as unsurpassable limits to human activity. It will tend either towards positivism, the view that the existing world of fact is all that can or ought to be, or towards moralism, the view that there is a realm of value, of the ought, that absolutely transcends any possible realm of fact. Above all, it will tend to deny the reality of conflict, of real as opposed to merely verbal or conceptual contradiction. For the elements in a conflict are not merely different from one another, they are absolutely opposed to each other. Yet to be in conflict, they are intimately involved in each other, to the point even that the very existence of each depends on the other. The capitalist class and the proletariat, for example, periodically face each other not merely with different interests and needs, but in a potential war of annihilation. Yet the existence of one depends on the existence of the other. There can be no capital without a mass of expropriated labor power, a proletariat, to exploit. And the moment the proletariat seizes the means of production and thereby liquidates the capitalist class, it begins the process of its own deproletarianization, of the transformation of itself into an association of free producers. A and non-A, in a case of real contradiction, far from being separable, are so involved in each other's existence that one must assert A is non-A. Formal thinking, accordingly, always tends to subsume conflict as mere appearance under some overarching, essential harmony. Another feature of formal thinking is worth observing briefly. When it is systematically formulated as a philosophy, it leads inexorably to philosophical idealism, even when the intention or tendency of the thinker is to assert a materialist worldview. The logic of this is easy to see. Formalism, as we have seen, involves or reflects the conception that only the unchanging, non-temporal, and self-sufficient is truly real. But ideas, the products of the mental operation of abstraction, of disregarding the flux and chaotic intertwining of immediate sensuous experience, possess just those features that formal thinking takes as essence. Products of thinking, therefore, are taken for the only or final reality, where this immediate identification of thought and being, of idea and reality, is consciously affirmed by the thinker. The result is an open idealism. The world as a whole is regarded as the product, construction, emanation of some mind, either my own individual mind or some social or collective mind or some divine mind. Where the thinker is not conscious of this identification, the result is a hidden idealism that characterizes all pre-Marxian materialism, or almost all. In classical atomism, for example, the atoms, regarded as self-sufficient, unchanging, absolutely discrete entities, precisely the product of mental activity, were taken as the ultimately real. Dialectical materialism, with its conscious insistence on the moment of non-identity of thought and being, with its insistence that knowledge is essentially not just accidentally or contingently, but essentially approximation of the mental product and the material reality and an ongoing historical process of knowing is the first consistently materialist theory in history. Formal metaphysical method is characteristic not only of ancient and medieval thought, but also of modern bourgeois theory. It has become more subtle, less drastic and consistent, but in some respects, perhaps even more pervasive and more firmly anchored in the deepest levels of ideology. Even those bourgeois thinkers, like Locke, for example, who affirmed and placed at the very center of their theorizing those events, revolutions, that most crassly defy comprehension in static and conflict-free terms, remain captives of it. Even the greatest of them, Hegel, the philosopher of the French Revolution and its aftermath, who consciously made the destruction of formalism and metaphysics and the establishment of dialectic his central, in a certain sense, his single theoretical goal, in the end remained a formalist, a metaphysician, an idealist. For Locke, for example, human beings are by nature discrete individuals equipped with certain natural rights to struggle to live in their own way by their own efforts, to defy and punish transgressions of that right from others, and above all, to appropriate property, as private property, so much of the earth as they can use and as they can do through their own labor. Locke has an ingenious theory of money to explain why even the most immense capital accumulations do not overstep the bounds of this natural right. But we can't go into this here. States are established by contract among human beings, which involves the renunciation of their right as individuals to defy and punish infringements of natural right. But this also limits the power of the state. As soon as it begins to infringe natural right, it loses legitimacy. From this, Locke derives the right of revolution. But the settlement that emerged from the English Revolution did, for Locke, was precisely to assure that government would henceforth be limited to its contractual function. Notice that there is not the slightest awareness that the English Revolution involved the establishment of anything essentially new. There is not the slightest awareness that a developing social order, capitalism, through that revolution was battering down the barriers to its development. Rather, the basic features of that new social order, the socialization of individuals as discrete entities, contract freely entered into, the qualitative identity of all kinds of labor, are regarded as the eternal essence of humanity. There is not the slightest awareness that life and death conflict, real contradiction, is at the base of the state. It is rooted, rather, for Locke, in that muted tension terminating in a meeting of minds advantageous for everyone, the contract. There can, of course, for Locke, be no question of a social class as an agent of revolution, of a social group constituted within the existing society whose needs and interests, as it defines them for itself, require the overthrow of the established social or political order. The real agency of revolution, for Locke, is rather the supra-historical, non-social nature of man, and what the revolution does is merely re-establish the rule of this nature, this eternal essence, in empirical reality. This nature also, accordingly, establishes an absolute limit which human beings in their activity cannot overstep. In Hegel, the question is much more complex, for he was an intensely self-conscious dialectician who wanted to destroy all the fixities and rigidities of formalism. Almost everything in each of his works is becoming contradiction, the emergence of the new, the negation of the negation. Again and again, when one studies him, it appears that he is dissolving all metaphysical eternal entities. Even his famous spirit seems to become a mere metaphor for the comprehensibility of the course of humanity through its history, on the one hand, and for the patterns and regularities human beings discover in nature during that course, on the other. Yet, in the end, he took it all back. And this can be seen especially clearly in his interpretation of the French Revolution, the consolidation of its achievements through the Napoleonic Wars, and the state. Hegel affirmed unconditionally the French Revolution and its consequences. He saw in it the liberation of what he called civil society, the sphere where individuals confront each other with their own individual egoistic interests and needs and interact to satisfy those needs, a freeing of this civil society from the irrationalities and arbitrariness of the old regime. At the same time, though, unlike the classical economists and the French and English bourgeois political thinkers, Hegel did not suppose that out of this interaction, this scramble for egoistic satisfaction, a harmony of the whole would automatically emerge. On the contrary, Hegel saw with more clarity than any thinker before Marx and Engels that this interaction was inherently antagonistic, contradictory. Above all, though he did not see clearly social classes within bourgeois society, as opposed to the third estate against the classes of the old regime, he did see an inexorable tendency towards a polarization of that society into what he calls the rich and the poor. But out of these antagonisms, out of the destruction of civil society which they threatened, he did not see the possibility of any different kind of social organization, an odd limitation in a thinker whose whole stock in trade was apparently the negation of the negation, the emergence of the new through contradiction. Rather, he saw the solution of these antagonisms in the state, a strong state which would constantly intervene to ameliorate the antagonisms generated in civil society. This relation, civil society-state, was an unsurpassable limit for Hegel. He had nothing but contempt for the communist and utopian socialist theories that emerged in the left wing of the French Revolution and after it. This final limit to human practice, Hegel expresses by calling the state, finally, in reality, the restoration states of the post-Napoleonic settlement, the realization of objective reason, a power standing over against every individual and partial group and maintaining harmony in the face of the absolute antagonism engendered in civil society. What this objective reason really is, we can understand thanks to Marx's analysis of the fetishism of commodities, or reification, as it has become fashionable to call it. In a commodity-producing society, human beings relate to each other primarily through the exchange of products of their individual labor. The social relations involved in production and in the satisfaction of needs are not immediately social, as they are, for example, in a society where production is consciously planned. The individual finds himself confronting an objective power to which he must somehow conform. The price of his groceries is simply given to him. The wage he receives for working is simply given to him. It is not apparent that these objective realities are themselves the product of human activity. And indeed, for each individual, they are not the result of human, that is, any individual's activity. They thus appear, and at one level in fact are, independent forces standing over against human beings. Now these objective forces obey certain laws quite independently of anyone's will. Classical political economy investigated these phenomena and discovered some of these laws, but it treated them as what they appear, natural, unchangeable, objective givens not produced by human activity in history. It was first Marx who exposed the roots of these laws in human history, in human doing, and in a sense, that is what all of capital is about, and the theory of commodity fetishism is a central element in that exposure. Now, Hegel's objective reason, embodied in the state that maintains the harmony of an antagonistic society, is precisely a mystified expression of that power which operates according to laws and is hence rational, that stands over against every individual in civil society, which is in reality the commodity-producing society. And in fact, this objective reason, this mystified version of the laws governing a commodity-producing society, become the very model for Hegel's ultimate category, spirit. This can be shown through a point-by-point analysis of Hegel's works. So in the end, Hegel, as much as Locke, though in a far more complex and subtle way, treats the historical, literally temporary, essence of capitalist society as the eternal essence, not only of all society or of all man, but of all reality, not only history and society, but also nature. And this is not just a little flaw that turns up here and there in Hegel's thought. It covers this whole dialectical development as a mystifying veil. It is indeed an absolute idealism, a pure abstraction, produced by the human mind at one moment in its history, regarded as the essence of all being. One ironic consequence of all this for Hegel was the almost complete divorce of theory and practice. Ideas rule the world, proclaimed the arch-idealist, yet the philosopher, the man of ideas, is impotent. For this notion of rationality demands that action in its results never be identical with the intended result. Otherwise, the objective force of reason standing over against the individual would become identical with the reason or the interest or the passion of the individual and hence be dissolved. The other side of this is that once this understanding has arisen, there is nothing fundamentally more to do. Once I comprehend the rationality of the whole standing over against my contingent accidental wishes and desires, I am reconciled to it. Thus, it was Napoleon, for Hegel, who couldn't have cared less about spirit, who realized in action the world spirit, regardless of what Napoleon's goals and passions were. Hegel, who was much concerned about spirit, could only interpret and explain what Napoleon had done. Hegel, I think it remains fair to say, even 100 years after Marx and Engels said it, was a culmination of bourgeois philosophy, indeed of bourgeois theory generally, if we accept the natural sciences. It has been downhill ever since. However significant particular achievements of scholarship and of limited theorizing and of expressing the agony of the decaying society may have been, methodological formalism and metaphysics dominate thinking. However much vehement verbal repudiation of formalism and metaphysics there may be, usually significantly enough, accompanied with the vigorous assertion that dialectic is metaphysics. One little example. The dominant sociological theories in the U.S. today are almost all variants, one sort or another, of functionalism, whose high priest and most systematic thinker is Professor Talcott Parsons of Harvard. The underlying conception of functionalism, as Parsons quite explicitly states, is that social systems tend, by nature, we should add for completeness, to equilibrium. Thus, when we investigate any social structure or institution, the family, say, or a class or a state, the first and last question we must ask ourselves is, what function does this structure or institution serve in preserving the stability, the homeostasis of the society? When we have described that function in connection with the function of all the other structures we can investigate, we have understood the given structure. When we discover a structure that seems ineluctably to tend to disrupt rather than preserve the social system, we call it dysfunctional and ask, what changes in the other structures would be required to eliminate this dysfunction. When we have answered that question, we understand the dysfunctional structure. The individuals in the society are conceived as the passive bearers of social roles that are functional. When an obstreperous dysfunctional individual, a YSA or SWP, or for example, turns up, we have a failure of socialization, a dysfunctional educational or socializing institution of some sort. Dysfunctions, if they are not tended to, may accumulate and destroy the social system. That, however, is simple catastrophe. What, if anything, comes afterwards has no continuity with the given social system. It is beyond the horizon of theorizing and, of course, of practice. The formalistic metaphysical character of such theory is surely evident. In the basic assumption that social systems tend toward equilibrium, we find a modern restatement of the ancient A equal A. Homeostasis, self-identity, is the essence. In the denial of real contradiction, the isolation of elements tending towards disruption from the totality of the system itself, we find the old relegation of the negative to the realm of the merely appearing, contrasted absolutely to the harmonious essence. In the notion of the disruption of the existing system as pure catastrophe, there speaks the old A or non-A, either the existing system or some wholly indeterminate other. In the very notion of the social system, not any particular social system with a history, we find again the timeless essence uncontaminated by becoming. In the definition of the individual as the mere bearer of a social role imposed on him by the system, there is a tolerable statement of one level of the truth about capitalist society, but here, as in Locke and even in Hegel, this layer is absolutized and universalized. Parson falls victim to the fetishism of commodities and turned into the essence of the social system. The analysis could continue indefinitely. One thing is clear, however. Such a theory must, from beginning to end, be profoundly anti-revolutionary. Revolutions just aren't supposed to happen. When they do, they are essentially accidental. As guide to practice, if the action led by such a theory can be called practice at all, it justifies merely a kind of technocratic manipulation. But the point, as Marx tells us, is not merely to interpret the world, but to change it. To change the world, not to eliminate the dysfunctions from it. For this, we require a method of thought that approaches the world as historical, as a reality that has become, that is changing, and that it is thus changeable. For this, we require a method based on the recognition that, in fact, all knowing arises in practice, and when this relation is suppressed or obscured, knowledge is transformed into illusion. A method that leads us to look behind every abstraction, every product of thinking, for the real material base of it in human activity. For this, we need a method based on the recognition that there is no eternal, unpassable limit on what human beings may achieve for themselves, and that therefore instructs us to search for and identify the real material forces of change that have developed within the existing order. For this, we need a method that leads us to look for real contradiction, to analyze it in the most concrete possible fashion, and to intervene with whatever power and consciousness we may possess on the side that represents the negation of the negation, the side that is the bearer of the qualitatively new in the world. And this, very abstractly, is what dialectical materialism is, the only consistent dialectic and the only consistent materialism. Dialectic and revolution converge today as, to return to the beginning of our discussion, they did in antiquity, only both have been dialectically transformed.
Thank you.